This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. We have ample evidence now to support the proposition that U.S. President Donald Trump has a very different approach to international affairs than his predecessors, both Democratic and Republican. He has often shown a greater affinity for America's adversaries, such as Russia, than for its traditional allies, such as the European Union. He recently shook up his foreign policy team, replacing the more conservative but mainstream national security advisors with more hawkish individuals, such as John Bolton. On the economic front, Gary Cohn, who espoused traditional conservative views in favor of free trade and against the imposition of recent tariffs on imported steel and aluminum, was replaced with advisors who hold more protectionist and nationalist views. Some analysts say Mr. Trump may also be motivated to undo many of the signature foreign policy achievements of his predecessor, Barack Obama, to wit, Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, and most recently, the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. In doing so, Mr. Trump has further alienated and even antagonized America's traditional allies, who are parties to these agreements. The Trump administration's recent recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and the opening of the embassy last week have upended decades of American policy and bucked the international consensus that the future of the contested city should be decided through final status negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. Well, with us to analyze the rationale for and implications of U.S. foreign policy under President Donald Trump are two distinguished analysts. Daniel Twining is president of the International Republican Institute, and that's an international organization that helps foster democratic and accountable societies around the globe. Prior to taking the helm at IRI, Daniel was a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund for the United States. He's also a former advisor to Senator John McCain. And Brian Katulis, he's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a liberal-leaning think tank based here in Washington, where he focuses on national security. Previously, Brian worked at the National Security Council and the Departments of State and Defense under former President Bill Clinton. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Well, Daniel Twining, let me begin with you. What's your assessment of President Trump's foreign policy thus far and implications for America's image and role in the world?
Well, I think we should think about the fact that we have an American foreign policy. We don't have a one-man system. If you set aside some of the style points, the last four Democratic Party political conventions have called for the United States to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. A number of Democrats have been very outspoken against Iran's nuclear proliferation and terrorism and other criminal activities. The president is on a negotiating track with North Korea, which is something that President Bill Clinton first tried to do. So I actually see some continuity as much as perhaps some change.
Turning to you, Brian Katulis, do you see more continuity than contrast? How do you see it?
I think America is in retreat, unlike we've seen perhaps since the 1930s. When you look at the big picture and you strip away the rhetoric and the tweeting, and you look at the actions of a Trump administration, you see an administration that essentially has withdrawn from some of the more traditional views on trade and staying engaged on global economic policy, certainly has withdrawn from the freedom agenda and supporting democracy and human rights around the world, and has curiously aligned itself with countries like Russia and have not stood up to this, despite sort of a lot of the bluster and the rhetoric that we see. And I think, unfortunately, Trump is a consequence of a lot of the dynamics that are taking place inside of the Democratic and Republican parties on foreign policy, where we've seen a collapse of internationalism. I think he's a reflection of a retreat that began under Barack Obama, but has accelerated under his leadership.
Turning back to you, Daniel Twining, and I do acknowledge what you said about the Iran nuclear deal and North Korea. No question about it, both Republicans and many Democrats were opposed to the nuclear deal.
But there's a difference between being opposed to it and pulling out sort of unilaterally. But let me get back to another point. Mr. Trump talks a lot about keeping his campaign promises. And of course, we know that many presidents, not just President Trump, like to keep their promises on the campaign trail. But some critics say that more than many of his predecessors, President Trump does make foreign policy through more of a domestic political lens, very concerned about his base, perhaps, and not as attentive to the national security implications of some of these decisions.
I mean, I'm struck that you think other presidents don't make foreign policy on the basis of their domestic political base. I mean, Barack Obama campaigned on the premise that he would get America out of Iraq, which was purely a domestic political consideration, because he did. He withdrew all American forces from Iraq, and Iraq collapsed after 7 or 8 years in which we had helped bring stability and a working system to Iraq. We have rectified that error. President Obama talked about global nuclear disarmament and world peace. That's something that we would all like to see. But in fact, nuclear contestation and proliferation, of course, have spiked since he made some of those declarations in 2009. So, of course, they're always domestic politics. The last thing I would say on this, though, is that I think every president has a duty to appeal to Americans' best nature. The American public can be rallied to support strong foreign policy leadership. Right? But we have to explain why. We have to explain that if Russia and China and Iran are on the march in the world, that is a more dangerous world for the United States. The kind of retreat from leadership that I think we have seen in previous periods, led by both Republicans and Democrats. So there is a bipartisan phenomenon here. But in fact, domestic politics, I think, can support a robust foreign policy.
Well, turning to you, Brian, but I do want to underscore that I did say that all presidents make foreign policy to some extent through a domestic political lens. What I was trying to say was that President Trump seems to take it to a new level, at least in the eyes of some people. How do you see that, Brian Katulis?
Yeah, I think Daniel said something really important, which was presidents should appeal to our best nature. We have a president in the United States just a few days ago who basically called refugees animals, has, in my view, appealed to the worst nature of some of the base instincts in parts of our society that's there. And it saddens me because I've characterized in some ways Trump's approach to foreign policy, when you include especially the immigration approach, as this gated community approach, as if America is Mar-a-Lago and that we can build walls and seal ourselves off from those walls. And I do think that there is strong bipartisan support that is in contrast to that view. But we have a president of the United States right now who essentially ran on a campaign of America first versus soulless globalism. It wasn't Republicans versus Democrats. It was a very much retrenched isolationist view. I held out some hope in the first year that his administration might take shape and that there might be more continuity between him and other presidencies. And I think there are some elements with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis still in there. But if you look at the new complexion of the advisors and you look at the president himself at his core and the language he uses, it is outside the bounds of what we've seen in America since we've become a foreign policy power in the world. And it's, I think, alarming to a lot of folks on both sides of the aisle.
A quick question for both of you before we get into some of the big decisions. First to you, Daniel Twining. Now, we have a loyal listener in Kenya who says, and we've heard this from other critics, in addition to maybe some merits on which President Trump is making these decisions, whether withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal or Paris Climate Accord or imposing tariffs, et cetera, on some of our adversaries and allies. This fan says, well, it looks like President Trump just is motivated to undo everything President Obama did on the world stage. Do you think there's anything to that criticism?
I think there's something to it, but it's not the first president, again, who has wanted to make a break from his predecessor, right? I mean, President Obama essentially ran as being kind of the anti-George W. Bush. This is normal. This is why we have elections, and it's not unhealthy, actually. I mean, one thing I would say is that this is where the role of Congress comes in. I actually don't think the president is alone in making American foreign policy, and I don't think most of the world understands the role of Congress in the foreign policy process. The reason President Trump was able to so easily withdraw from the Iranian nuclear accord is that President Obama never sent it up to Congress for a vote on ratification, right? So if you are a president, the way to lock in your foreign policy accomplishments is to secure bipartisan support in the Congress, and that turns them into something that endures.
an interesting point to you, Brian Katulis. President Trump is basically undoing everything that President Obama did, not just on the world stage, but even domestically. What do you make of that particular argument?
It's not producing much of value that makes us stronger in the world or sustainable. I think every president does have this instinct to try to have his own imprint. What's different, and I think people need to understand about President Trump, is that he is an anomaly compared to the presidents we've had essentially since the Cold War and the post-Cold War period. And I think he's a product also of the political dynamics we've had in this country since 9/11, where there's been a hyper-partisan debate about national security, which I think is unfortunate, coming from both Democrats and Republicans, and that we've treated these issues, whether it's the war on terror, the Iraq war, Afghanistan, as fights between ourselves that have divided us. And Trump sort of ran a truck through all of that in 2014 and 15 when he announced his candidacy, and has divided the country. And I think as a consequence, other countries like China and Russia will actually reshape the world to their benefits while we're spending a lot of time on what I think are tactical debates and even things like the Iran nuclear deal, which I think are very important, ultimately to me amount to a tactical debate about how do we prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And the way that we've debated this for the past 3 or 4 years has actually been corrosive in our own discussion about national security and has led us sort of down a path that has weakened our hand. I think Trump ultimately and his move on the Iran nuclear deal makes America weaker in the world, not stronger.
We'll have more on the decision vis-a-vis withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Daniel Twining, he's president of the International Republican Institute, and Brian Katulis, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow, specializing in national security at the Center for American Progress. We're analyzing foreign policy under U.S. President Donald Trump. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to Facebook fan Zayar Rauf from Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Daniel Twining, and let's talk about this decision to withdraw the United States from the Iran nuclear deal. You said earlier that it wasn't very popular, certainly among most Republicans and even many Democrats. And yet, critics would still say that unilaterally doing this without a plan B is perhaps precipitous and reckless. And it also antagonizes our allies, the other signatories to the agreement, mostly Europeans. And it might even accelerate destabilizing activities by Iran in the region and perhaps make them more inclined to abdicate their role in the nuclear deal, to not pursue a nuclear weapon.
So I understand critics always want to blame America, but I'd like to go back to the foundation of instability in the Middle East today, which is the fact that you have the world's greatest sponsor of terrorism in the state of Iran, a government that does not run free and fair and accountable elections, that has a religious leadership superimposed on what looks like a democracy on paper. This is a country that has been sponsoring wars and terrorist activities in at least 10 countries all over the Middle East. Iranian forces have been killing Americans. Iran has been almost single-handedly propping up the Assad regime in Syria, including through battlefield support. The fundamental cause of instability in the Middle East is the nature of the regime in Iran and its activities. And in fact, you had Iranians take to the streets in dozens of cities across Iran in December and January, protesting against their government's illegitimate foreign wars and foreign adventurism, and saying, why don't we actually focus on developing Iran? That is the context in which we are having a debate about the nuclear deal, and we can talk more about it. But I'll just say the reason many of us were not very happy with the original Iran nuclear agreement is that it lifted economic sanctions on Iran. $100 billion spilled into Iran from the global economy. Much of that has been used by the regime to fund foreign wars and terrorist activities.
To you, Brian Koutoulis, notwithstanding everything Daniel said, others would argue, look, pulling out of the deal without a plan B, without really having a strong strategy to counter Iran in the region, which some critics say we still do not have, they say that it's a bit premature, to say the least. How do you see it?
I see it as unilateral disarmament. I didn't think the deal was strong as it could have been. But to be clear, this is not pulling out of the deal. This is violating a deal that was not a treaty, but it was a deal between the leading powers of the world and Iran. And the leading powers of the world, minus the U.S., are still in it. So again, when I say that the U.S. is unilaterally disarming, we're essentially taking what is, I think, a tool, an imperfect one, that actually helps us monitor and constrain Iran's behavior on the nuclear front. And we're saying, okay, we're throwing it out the door, and we haven't replaced it with anything else. The biggest gap to shift to the region is there's absolutely no strategy in place right now to counter, compete, and contest Iran's influence in the region. The week after President Trump gave his speech on Iran last fall, I was in Israel. Top Israeli security officials said to me, we like the tone, but we don't see a strategy. We see Israel now having to defend itself against threats from Iran that they'd never seen before, in part because of President Trump's passive appeasement of the Iranian threat in the region. My colleagues were in Iraq that same week, and they talked to Iraqi leaders. This was in October of last year. What do you think about President Trump's speech on Iran? And one of them said, big mouth, small hands, meaning he speaks a lot, but he actually has no tools on the ground. And I would argue that some of the tools that are essential in competing and contesting Iran's influence are the sorts of things I've worked on, the sort of thing that Daniel's organization, IRI, in helping people build a political culture of their own, of freedom and democracy, to stand on their own. And guess what's happened? We've gut and cut those tools, first under President Obama, and President Trump has continued that process. So we talk a good game about countering Iran in the region, and I agree with the assessment, but we're not doing anything meaningful to actually counter it. We're unilaterally disarming.
Well, that's an interesting point, particularly the one you made about not doing enough on democracy promotion, which would seem to be an important component. But we may or may not get to that. But very quickly, back to you, Daniel Twining. Again, playing a little bit the devil's advocate with you. Another part of this withdrawal from the Iran deal is that many critics say we are really alienating our most important allies, the transatlantic alliance. And in addition, because Mr. Trump has directed maximum sanctions to be applied to companies that continue to do business with Iran, and of course that is causing alarm in France and Germany, this could again have a byproduct of splitting the Atlantic alliance. So does the withdrawal from the deal, even if on the merits you think it's important, does the damage done by doing so unilaterally outweigh, you know, the importance of these allies?
So look, allies make us stronger. Allies compound and amplify American power and influence in the world. And we have no more important allies than our allies in Europe and the NATO alliance, which have kept the peace in Europe for 70 years. Our Middle Eastern allies, however, had a very different view of the Iran deal. The biggest proponents of America ending what they saw as a bad deal were our closest allies in the Middle East, including the government of Israel, including the government of Saudi Arabia, including the governments of our other Gulf allies who are core military partners. So it's actually not true that our allies were against America getting out of the deal. Our allies in Iran's neighborhood were very much in favor of it because they have seen how Iran has used the cover of the deal and the billions and billions of dollars in resources that have become available to the regime in Tehran through the deal to further destabilize the Middle East. But, you know, I think good people can disagree on this. And America's in a hard position when, in fact, one group of our allies is telling us, look, this is a bad deal and you need to get out of it. And another group of our allies is saying, look, this deal is important to us.
Brian, you get to weigh in because some might argue, well, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Arab states plus Israel, notwithstanding great allies, they are not as strong, perhaps, as the transatlantic alliance. People are worried that this unilateral withdrawal from this nuclear deal could have a very deleterious effect on our relationships with the NATO allies and the transatlantic allies.
We have very important partners in Europe, and they're democratic. They share our values. I strongly support also our cooperation with countries like Saudi Arabia. They're good partners, but they don't share our values. What worries me about the transatlantic relationship is not the Iran nuclear deal only. It's the fact that President Trump, with his America First approach to issues like trade and the economy, is actually alienating some of our closest allies. Add to that the fact that last year, bipartisan support in Congress passed sanctions against Russia for its own actions. And we have a president of the United States that was slow to implement and introduce those sanctions. We have a president of the United States who fired his second national security advisor the day after that national security advisor said, please don't congratulate President Putin for his reelection. And again, going back to what I said earlier, this is an anomaly. For those of you living overseas, I'm a proud American and want my country to succeed, and my president to succeed, and our system to succeed. But the president of the United States that we have right now in the Oval Office is an anomaly and is not operating within the bounds of any Republican or Democratic administration before.
Picking up on your characterization of Mr. Trump as sort of an anomaly, let's go to North Korea briefly. So, Daniel Twining, you mentioned earlier that this is potentially positive, that you may be cautiously optimistic about an opening with North Korea, finally getting to an agreement where they would denuclearize. And yet we've had this back and forth. Now, we don't know. The so-called summit in Singapore is up in the air. And one more thing for you to respond to, and that is some even hawkish thought leaders have said that they are worried that a rather inexperienced commander-in-chief could get suckered into taking a bad deal because he badly wants to have a diplomatic triumph. What about those pitfalls?
So the president has got to go into a North Korean negotiation with his eyes wide open to the fact that this is a totalitarian regime. The entire country is a gulag. North Koreans not only have no rights, they have no freedom of information to even understand that they are living in a kind of Orwellian dynastic country with almost no exposure to the outside world, with a family-like mafia structure running the country. This is a very difficult country to imagine trusting. The U.S. has tried this before. We tried it in the 90s during the Clinton administration with the support of Congress. We set up a disarmament in return for energy resources deal, which fell apart because North Korea immediately started cheating on the deal. I worked in the Bush administration. We tried it again then, a negotiating track, a lifting of sanctions, some generous economic resources in return for North Korean denuclearization. They immediately started cheating on that deal. So it's not clear what has changed that would cause this country to be trustworthy. The other thing, I was in Korea 2 weeks ago, and when we talk about denuclearization, we in America, we think that means North Korea has to dismantle its nuclear weapons and infrastructure. However, Kim Jong-un has a very different definition of denuclearization, which is the withdrawal of the American nuclear umbrella that protects South Korea and the withdrawal of American forces who have protected South Korea since the Korean War. And so I think among many things that many of us worry about is the fact that we're not even talking about the same thing.
And Brian Katulis, once again, implications of the United States unilaterally breaking its word, I guess you could say, or pulling out of the Iran deal, does that have any implications for North Korea and how the world may see the United States as a partner to other negotiations? And again, this concern that perhaps President Trump, so interested in claiming diplomatic triumph, may make concessions that are not in America's interest.
I worry less about what North Koreans are looking at in terms of the Iran nuclear deal and more in terms of just Trump's erratic nature and his nature, period. I had a Saudi official tell me once that they saw in Trump a man who was easily flattered, so they're going to flatter him with sword dances and things like this, and then try to play him like a fiddle to their own interests. And I think that could possibly happen. I think Trump has enough wise people around him to prevent that from happening. But I worry. I worry when I hear early on, even before negotiations have effectively begun, some people in the administration floating the idea of eliminating the U.S. military presence in Korea. That all seems very premature, and to put that out there in the public space doesn't seem wise to me. But it goes back to sort of the broader point. I don't think this is a president that is deeply personally interested in foreign affairs, except when he can get accolades. He was doing his rallies in the heartland where he was getting people to chant Nobel Prize before the negotiation had even begun. But this is a man who is mostly centered on his America First agenda, is mostly concerned about these issues in many ugly ways of identity politics, of trying to redefine America and who we are. And as a consequence, I think countries like China and Russia see more of an open field to do what they want in different places. I think Iran, definitely, especially after this violation of the nuclear agreement, North Korea perhaps, will continue to test the limits of their power in the world. And that is a consequence, I think, will be a more chaotic world. Trump, again, puts it all under a banner of strength and American leadership, but the world and our adversaries and our allies are reading it more correctly. They see a country that's essentially in retreat.
Gentlemen, I hope we'll have an opportunity to continue this conversation I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Daniel Twining, president of the International Republican Institute, and Brian Katulis, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for a terrific conversation.
Thank you, Carol.
Thanks.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.